Hiatus celebrating the July the 4th holidays. We had ourselves a nice little break, but we're back for the next three Tuesdays leading up to Linux World Expo. The week of Linux World Expo, we will not have a show on Tuesday night. That would be the 2nd of August, but we're going to be having shows. No, that would be the 3rd, excuse me, the 3rd of August. But we're going to be having shows all day long at the Linux World Expo, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of August. If you happen to be in the San Francisco market, drop us an email at staff@thelinuxshow.com. We could use help from a couple of people to help us set up our broadcast stage, as well as people who might be able to come and hang out with us during the expo itself to help us do some things at the broadcast stage. We always like to get local members of LUG groups involved in our Linux show broadcast. So if you're a BALUG member, spread the word amongst your fellow members that we're looking for a half dozen or so volunteers to help us out for a half day or a full day or whatever time you got available for us, just to help us do our broadcast at Linux World Conference. If you haven't signed up for Linux World Conference, it's not too late. You can still sign up for the expo. If you don't want to go to the conference is great, but there is the Taste of Linux event that's going on during the expo itself. It sort of gives you a little scaled-down mini version of what's going on in the conference. So if you're short on bucks, it'll at least give you a taste of what's going on at the conference level. But, you know, if you got the money, it's one of the best conferences you can attend. So come see us there at the Linux World Conference and Expo. But we've got most of the crew here with us tonight. We do have Doc absent. Well, he's half absent. Doc is listening to us via the IRC. So I'm saying hello to Doc on the IRC right now. And so Doc is going to throw us his questions when we get into segment number two. That is, if he doesn't fall asleep right now. He's, I believe, at 2 a.m. time. He's packing for our airplane out tomorrow morning. But the rest of the crew is here tonight. How are you doing tonight, Arnie?
Doing fine. It's doing fine. Still waiting for the big earthquakes here this summer that were predicted by, what's the name of that university? Well, whatever. I think it's MIT who predicted it. And meanwhile, it's over 100 degrees every day, so we're trying to keep the vegetable garden watered. And
well, that's good earthquake weather.
Yeah, perfect earthquake weather, and got the air conditioning in my office here is cranking out and doing its best to keep it below 80 in here. But other than that, everything's fine.
Good, good. How are you doing, Russ, on the other end of the country?
Or I'm busy.
At the other end of the country.
I'm busy and waterlogged in Maryland. One of the interesting things here is we don't have to worry so much about watering gardens, especially since I think two out of the last three nights, some of the lead stories on the TV news have been pictures of cars floating by with people having to be rescued from them.
Saves on gas that way, Russ.
Oh, yes, indeedy. It saves on lots of things. It's, you know, bath water is easy to come by, but that's what we've been dealing with here. It's kind of bizarre, but par for the course.
Yeah, you need one of those aqua cards. That'll get you through.
Duck foot.
Yep. Kevin and I are here in Chicago. Everything's doing well. At least I think. Kevin, are we all set?
Oh, yeah, seem to be.
And we're still working our problems out with the long-promised TVX to allow you people out there, you listeners, the opportunity to call into the shows. We're still working on it. It's taken a lot longer than we anticipated, but we do have a person who is working with us to get us through those problems as rapidly as possible. I am really hoping to have this problem resolved in time for Linux World Expo, because I think it would be a lot of fun if we could take VOIP calls during the expo. Can't promise it at this point, but we'll see if we can get that done. And also joining us tonight are a couple of guests. One is a regular guest, almost an official full-time panel member, but not quite. Eric Raymond's at a restaurant. I don't know if he's actually listening right at the moment. Eric, are you there?
I am, in fact, listening.
Are you eating yet?
No, my food has not yet arrived.
What are you going to have?
I'm going to have a wasabi beef sandwich.
Ah, sounds good.
Yes, it is very good.
Yeah. And also joining us tonight, replacing Doc for the evening, is a stand-in panelist, Brian Proffitt from Linux Today. How are you doing tonight, Brian?
I'm doing quite well, Mr. Gerhardt.
Always a pleasure to have Brian sit in for one of the panelists.
Yes, I've been listening to your tales of floods and earthquake, and we just had a tornado pass about 25 miles away this evening.
Oh, joyful.
So I'm just sort of enjoying the near
Should have stuck your thumb out.
Yeah, I know.
Brian, did you get mail from me earlier today called The Final Virus?
Yes, I did. We put that up on the site, and lots of readers are
that's interesting. I haven't seen it up there yet. This might be in our story roundup if we're going to have one before the second segment.
Yes, we are. No, it's there, Eric. I saw it.
It's there.
I was checking out Linux today just before the show, and it's there. So you can talk about that if you like.
Okay.
Actually, I think you talked about that 2 weeks ago, that you were writing it. So that must mean it's done, Eric.
What was that?
It must mean it's done.
Yes, it's done.
Is it in bookstores?
Oh, no. This is not a new book. The Final Virus is an essay, which I'll talk about when we get to our news roundup.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and do that. We'll go ahead and jump into segment number one. Russ, why don't you kick off a couple of your stories in segment number one tonight?
All righty. As usual, the links to these stories can be found on the Linux Show website, so you can hop over there and take a look. The first one that I have on my list is the French fry up their own GPL, which, very bad puns aside, is an interesting story about how some public agencies in France have decided that they wanted to have their own GPL-ish license that's built on principles of French law rather than English law. I'm not exactly sure what that's going to entail. I mean, whenever we see this sort of thing where someone creates a new open source license, I guess the first question that comes to my mind is why.
I can tell you why.
Go for it.
As speaking as the president of the OSI, we are the people who review these new licenses when they come off the box. And I have to tell you that most of them, I don't think that's true of this one, but most of them are simple acts of vanity. Some corporate legal department decides, well, if we pee in it, we'll make the flavor better.
Also, there's also an issue with the French in that they want the license in French.
Now, yeah, I'm not being that dismissive of this license. They have an actual reason to write a new
and
license.
I can understand that. But any international license that would be wanting to be in the language of the home country.
Yeah. And there are significant differences between French and Anglo-American law. There are all the differences between a common law system and a civil law system. And some of these have direct impact on the kind of contract law that would be at issue in drafting an open source license. So in this case, I think there are excellent reasons for them to have done this. I'm a little puzzled at the fact that they have not approached OSI for certification yet.
Hmm.
They had not approached whom?
I don't know. We haven't heard anything from them yet.
Okay. Well, surprisingly enough, the most negative commentary that has been expressed about this move by these French agencies has come from France. And not from the rest of the world, because I think, frankly, the rest of the world probably could care less. But the French chapter of the Free Software Foundation is a little bit peeved that they didn't come to them and work with them on the GPL, but that they did this all on their own, all quietly, without even considering discussing their new license with the Free Software Foundation. That could be good or bad, I suppose. I don't know. But
it sounds like they're two for two. They didn't talk to either organization.
Yeah, but I do think it does make sense to, when you do have a legal system that's so radically different from not only most of Europe, but, you know, the United States for sure, that they really do need to have a license that uses not necessarily the language when you're talking about French versus English, but when you're talking about the legal language, that can make a world of difference when you're talking about a legal system like the French have today. So it's probably a good thing for them. We'll see. I don't know. Any more else?
Yeah. Next one up is from Bloomberg.com, and it says, Linux Open Source Shows Way Forward for Business, by Matthew Lynn. This is, I don't want to spend much time summarizing the story, per se, but just make some comments. One of the first things you see, I think actually over on Linux Today, I picked this up, and there were some comments over there that said, you know, why is this so hard to understand? But basically, this story is talking about how the business model for open source and more importantly, the method in which the community exists and how it creates things and why it creates things, etc., is very, very important, number one, and it changes things. You know, it's more than just cheap software or a slightly different model, but something that actually, you know, starts off as what seems to be a pretty marginal activity by a group of geeks and has, you know, rapidly moving to the center of the software universe. And some of the Linux Today folks, you know, readers over there were saying, you know, so what? The thing that I'm finding, frankly, as I get out and around even more these days talking to people, is that some of the things that we consider very basic truths about the way the open source community works, the way what motivates people, the way that they interoperate and all these sorts of things, are lost, frankly, on a lot of the business community. They simply have no comprehension of a lot of the details of what's going on. They think it kind of irrelevant to the dollars and cents of the matter. But when it comes down to it, they're missing the point in a lot of ways. They're seeing price tags. They're seeing a different place to get software, but they don't understand that the nature of developing software, the very activity itself, basically, is being changed. And with open source and technology being such a key part of life these days, that means that a whole section of life is being altered underneath our feet. And there are a lot of people who simply don't understand. They just don't get it. And this is kind of a gentle article in a lot of ways, kind of beginning to point out some of the issues. You know, why are people afraid of it? You know, what's this business about not having control over the software, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's an interesting little piece and probably a pretty decent introductory piece to give to particularly managers that are just looking at the dollars and cents. They don't really understand that the dynamic has changed and the properties of working of developing software and of obtaining software are changing underneath our feet.
I would nominate the following quote for Doc Searle's quote machine on Linux Journal, and that is, because the key difference is single company doesn't try to control the whole technology. Why is that? And here's the quote. Because the technology has become so complex that no single organization can efficiently manage it. And this is a really, really good article. And this is kind of like his tagline. And he's exactly right on target. The technology has become too complex to be managed by one company. And if you doubt that, consider I give you Windows as evidence.
Okay. No, but this is a nice piece and worthy of some attention. My final one for the set tonight is over at www.computing.co.uk. So it may take a couple extra seconds to load on this side of the pond. It's called Open Debate, Focusing on Business Value. And it's reflecting on a panel that was held, including one of the first names that you see is the head of platform strategy for Microsoft. But overall, it's an interesting conversation, and not from what you can learn from it so much, I think, but frankly, the points that are brought up in this particular article, particularly about from the people who are not open source advocates, the points are the same points that I'm hearing all over the place. So if you are dealing with a situation where you're trying to convince people to look at open source seriously, it is worthwhile to read this article, if for no other reason than to see what's going on in people's heads. There are several of the current messages from Microsoft about why they are superior to Linux, blah, blah, blah. which are also very useful. But it's kind of interesting to see what people are thinking. So if you're in that situation, if you think that you're going to be talking to people, this is a good backgrounder.
Well, can you explain then, well, I'm not trying to be contrary to this particular article at all, just in view of the same basic thread, can you explain why Microsoft, at their current worldwide partner conference that's up in Toronto, why they have what appears to me to have gone backwards with their FUD. They're digging up exactly the opposite of some of the things that you were saying earlier about the single vendor stuff, saying, you know, that this is good. I'm baffled at Microsoft, the comments coming out of the Microsoft conference this week, because they, first of all, half of the comments that are coming out are focused on, well, yeah, Linux is a good clone of Unix, but no way is it close to Microsoft, it doesn't innovate, you know, blah, 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 all that typical FUD that they talk about how Linux sucks. But then on the reciprocation, in the same conversations, they're saying that, but Linux is good for us because it keeps us on its toes. I'm completely confused right now. Microsoft.
I think it's the audience, Jeff. I think it's because they were talking to the partners. I mean, he tailored that. I read those comments too, and they really tailored that message towards you know, their partners, and that, hey, we're never going to leave you. You know, that seemed to be the overall thrust of those comments, that we're not going to let you go, that you're going to be able to make money off of Microsoft, but you're never going to be able to really make money off of open source.
So let's step back and look at the context these remarks are being made in.
I'll let you step back in a second, Eric. Brian, I agree with you. That's what they're saying to that audience, but it's not a strategy.
No, I don't think it is a strategy. I think it's a cheerleading session.
That's a good way to put it.
I suppose it is.
I posted it up on Linux today because, you know, everybody likes to pick on Ballmer, you know. But as far, I don't know if I would read a full strategy. The only thing that was interesting to me is that they really, the strategic thing they mentioned in the article was that they were going to go after Novell customers, which that was the first time they publicly, that I know of, said that.
Something I've been thinking about a lot lately, especially since the latest Halloween document was slipped to me, is Microsoft is in a much more fundamental way in a defensive position than it was 6 months ago or a year ago. If you notice, the dynamic of a lot of these panels and these conferences have changed. Microsoft is hearing all the pro-open source arguments now, but they're not hearing them from advocates like me or technology evangelists or journalists. They're hearing them from their own customers.
Right.
That's the message that's coming out of roadshows like the Get the Facts thing in England and some of the other conference presentations we've seen recently. So I think
you mean the feedback that you mean, Eric, you mean the feedback they're getting from the customers at these conferences is negative towards the conference's position?
I think that's what we're hearing from reports on the Get the Facts roadshow and other similar things. So I think we have to interpret Microsoft's current positioning as, what do we do now that all those pro-open source arguments aren't coming out of the mouths of people like Richard Stallman and that crazy guy in Melbourne, but we're hearing them from the people that were expecting to buy high-margin server hardware from us. That's why I say they're in a much more defensive position than they were 6 months ago, because 6 months ago this wasn't really happening yet.
But also, Eric, there's also, if they're over in Europe doing it, one has to understand that in Europe Linux has a much more firm base. Much more firm.
It may also be a function of the vertical that we're talking about. One of the things I've gotten several different kinds of evidence about recently is that there are a couple of vertical markets in which we're in an early majority position here in the United States, notably financial services and the movie industry.
That's right.
So anybody with partner connections or regular contact with financial services people in the U.S. is more likely to have picked this stuff out of the atmosphere.
It seems to be the government agencies in Europe are picking up the ball, too.
Yeah.
And that's something that's not necessarily happening here yet. It's happening in various municipalities have adopted Linux. But
yeah, in general, Unicef's got a higher market share in Europe.
And but one thing, there is one government agency that uses Unix a lot, and it always has, and that is the Department of Justice. And we're seeing that moving to Linux just because it's a natural.
Yeah, one reason we can be fairly sure this goes not going to get anywhere in a federal lawsuit is because Linux is now running the federal court's information system.
Well, Unix has always run it, so.
But they switched to Linux recently.
Yeah, I know that.
The management agency that runs dockets and so forth for the U.S. federal courts, it's Linux machines all the way down now. I wonder if that means the judges will have to recuse themselves.
Yeah, the courts will have to walk out of the courtroom. Sorry.
So, Artie, why don't you give us a couple of your stories?
Okay, I have only, three or four here, and a couple of them are really, really small. One of them, I've got a link to a Rob Limo article from a couple of weeks ago, beginning of the month, called Linux Users Are Spoiled. And I'm citing this article, which is a good article, about what Linux users take for granted that Windows users don't know about, like ability to update individual packages without killing everything, and a few other things. And the reason why I cited that article is because Chris DiBona has written an addendum to this article called Why Linux Repositories Are a Huge Competitive Advantage for Linux. And this is a somewhat shorter article, and I put both links out up because I think people should read both of those again. This is just really good, straightforward advocacy. And Chris is, again, right on target. I recommend those two. Oh, here's another one. This one I got just before the last minute today. Speaking of financial services, Eric, New Zealand Stock Exchange is now switched over to Oracle and Linux.
Cool.
Speaking of financial services, and this is a pretty good. There's an article on from the New Zealand Herald, and that's a pretty good feather in our hat. Let's see one more here. Linux also has won another European contract. This is from Tech World, Matthew Roersma. And the French Ministry of Equipment shifts 1,500 servers off of Windows NT to Linux, or is in the process of doing it. They're going to be using Mandrake, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And which is Mandrake is firmly ingrained in with a French language version, so that makes sense. And this is one that Microsoft worked very long and hard to snag, and they lost it. And I can understand why you said what you said, Eric, earlier, that Microsoft is this they've turned the corner on a few things here, including ability to have their sales be automatic. Well, people are realizing that switching to Linux is cheaper than upgrading their Windows. And since Microsoft has already said they're not going to support NT forever now, that they want people to upgrade, it now becomes an elementary process to say, okay, How much will it cost us to upgrade to Windows 2003 or whatever version they're going to now, or Longhorn in the future? It's cheaper maybe to do Linux now and then stay with Linux than it would be to do those, to upgrade off of NT now and possibly have in 2 years an expensive Longhorn upgrade as well. Plus, they get to leverage their older equipment with Linux, and they might not be able to do that with Windows Path.
Arnie, that sounds a lot like the argument that the columnist in the Inquirer made yesterday. Did you see that one?
No, I didn't see that one.
It was actually, it threw some Linux Today readers off because those bad people didn't read the whole article. It started off with this whole big, long diatribe, all the arguments against Linux.
Oh.
But then the guy turned around and said, you could take the exact same argument and take the word Linux and replace it with Longhorn.
Yeah.
And all the arguments apply to Longhorn. And it was actually a very nifty little response to a lot of the arguments coming out of Microsoft.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and that's true because and the one thing that Linux doesn't have is lock-in. And I mean, if you want to, no one's going to force you to use any particular web server or any particular web server technology. I mean, there's a variety of different ways to go. Even when you choose Linux, it gives you a plethora of paths to take. I mean, you're not locked in anymore.
Not that that's always good. I think my friend Rob Lambley has been pointing out rather assiduously that it's a big problem that we still have two different desktops.
Wait a minute, we got more than two.
two major ones, GNOME and KDE. That's a real problem, and he's right about that.
We just lost power.
Huh?
I just lost power.
It's from an ISE point of view, that's the kiss of death. Well, which desktop do I develop for?
Absolutely. What I'd like to do before we end the first segment is I'd like to turn it over to first Eric and then Brian. Eric, there, I know you wanted to talk about your essay, and Brian, if you have a interesting story of the week.
I have a few I'd like to rattle off real quick.
Okay, you go first, Brian.
Oh, me? Oh, okay. Real fast, this is just stuff that kind of happened later in the day today. Fedora Core 3 Test 1 has been formally announced. Also, Red Hat had to redo their finances today, clear up some accounting errors, and I just checked their stock, and
it took a big
They took a big hit today. They got a 22.7% drop. Looked like, you know, I don't know if they're, you know, if anybody's making the connection between this and the recent departure of Kevin Thompson, their CFO. My eyebrows squeaked a little bit, but, you know, I'm sure there'll be no connection proven there.
You know what I think this is?
Yeah.
A buying opportunity.
A what?
A buying opportunity.
Oh, you know, that's a good point. Maybe I ought to buy some more Red Hat stock.
What stock were you discussing? I got to go reset a circuit breaker.
Red Hat. Yeah.
Couple other things. Progeny Debian 2.0 has been released, the beta, first beta of that. And also, it looks like for anybody who has a Mac, Yellow Dog Linux 4 is going to be a little bit late on their development. They're sending out a little press announcement today, sort of as background, talking about that because they are building completely on the Fedora Core project, they've had to really change their development methodology. I guess they worked a lot in the past with Red Hat on the inside, and they've had to adjust their, you know, who they're working with and how it's being done. So Yellow Dog Linux will probably be a bit behind schedule. And then the only other thing I've got is a little bit of community news. If anybody reads DistroWatch, I don't know if you've heard, but Robert Story from DistroWatch has been in the hospital recently. He is on the mend, but DistroWatch, I believe that's half of their team. So it's a little bit behind now. But Ladislav, I talked to him on email yesterday, and he is he's picking up the slack, and he's, you know, begs our indulgence. So that's all I have, really.
Okay, Eric. Okay, so I have been thinking about spam a lot lately and what to do about it, and I came to a horrible shuddering realization this morning that there is, in fact, something extremely effective that could be done about spam that would reduce the spam flood we're seeing by about 90%.
Shoot spammers.
And no. Actually, this is something something much easier for a single programmer to accomplish. If you were to write a virus whose purpose was to kill Windows machines and let it spread, that would go a long way towards alleviating the spam problem, because most of the spam out there is being sent by zombie networks of Windows machines. Now, I'm not advocating that anyone should do this. In fact, I'm frightened of the possibility that somebody is going to do this.
That is a frightening thought.
That's why I wrote an essay called The Final Virus. Okay, and the essay was cast as a sort of science fiction story set in June 2005, when millions of Windows users wake up to a blue screen of death that tells them, for spam to end, Windows must die. Your machine has been wiped. Unfortunately, it is all too easy to imagine some programmer out there who is bright enough to accomplish this getting fed up with seeing 400 copies of Sasser, NetSky, and the latest worm of the week in his mailbox and deciding he's going to do something about it. To do something about it wouldn't be very hard. There are virus-writing kits out there now that will let you insert a payload of your choice in a virus that propagates over a whole bunch of different channels, including Microsoft Messenger Service, Microsoft Update Channel, UPnP, and a whole bunch of vulnerabilities that, notably, do not involve sending spam. So my fear here is that somebody is actually going to do this. And why am I afraid of this? You'd think that it would be something that Linux advocates and open source advocates could kind of welcome. Well, the problem is, we'll get blamed.
Well, no. You will get blamed.
I'm coming on you, man.
Who are you saying, we?
Yeah. We'll get blamed, whether it's actually one of us or not, and I frankly don't think it's likely to be. Whether it's one of us or not, what Microsoft's going to do is they're going to say, well, you've got to look at who benefits, and then you've got to look at Linux.
Can we quickly point out Macintosh people?
That scares me, because there are people who are trying to have mandatory DRM legislation passed, and my worst-case scenario, which I mean, shivers run down my neck when I think about it, because I think it's actually plausible, is that some guy out there decides he's going to end the spam problem, unleashes the final virus to propagate to a whole bunch of Windows machines, wipe them, maybe keep a little bit of a reservoir of infection so that any Windows machine that connects to the net gets wiped, and the MPAA and the RIA and the BSA and Microsoft use this as the pretext to yell about cyber terrorism and get some kind of induced two or super DMCA bill passed. And because I think this is all too real a possibility, I've come to the unpleasant conclusion that somehow we got to think up a way to prevent the final virus from happening.
You know what, Eric? I have an even worse scenario. Microsoft could write that virus and get everybody to upgrade to Longhorn.
Oh, God, I'm not even that paranoid. Well, you're more paranoid than I am, even.
We need to have a, you know what we need to do on the Linux show? We need to have a conspiracy theory night. And invite all the usual suspects.
We
that would be a good
Art
one.
We need to get Art Bell back on the radio. We need to get Art Bell back on the radio.
Yeah, there you go.
Holy moly.
Oh, he's been back on weekends for quite a while.
Well, not when I listen to him, that's all. Well, we are up to the time for the first segment. We're going to take ourselves a break and see if we can get a hold of our guest for segment number two. This will probably be a little bit longer than normal break, so everybody just kick back and relax. Kevin, throw on a couple of tunes. I'd like to thank our sponsors for this week's show, the fine folks at IDG that are hosting us at Linux World Expo the first week of August, and as well as people from the Golden Group, the people who bring us to ISPCon. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, everybody. Just hang in there. We'll be right back.
He put on of his soul into a tenor saxophone. He had his way of talking, 'twas a language on his own. Life's story, love and glory, if you listen when he plays it for you. Now listen and listen and dig it. Can't you dig it? Lester Young is playing on his feeling. Dylan and Benson. Now someone might have told you Lester Young is out of style. But now I'm here to tell you press is happening.
It's explainable, I met someone. Unattainable, life's a bore. The world is...
And we're back.
This is segment number two of the Linux Show for July the 13th, 2004. We are going to have an interesting segment tonight. We invited Ken Brown, the I don't know if Ken's the founder. He can tell us that in a minute, but he's the president of the Alex de Tocqueville Institution. There's a little bit of a bio on the website, www.thelinuxshow.com. You can find out about Ken's background and his involvement with the Alex de Tocqueville Institute. We invited Ken here, of course. Obviously, if you're a regular listener of the Linux Show, this is Rockin' Science. You can guess the reason why I invited Ken. There's a little bit of a controversy over some of the content that has been published at the ADTIV site, and there's been a lot of flaming and things that have gone on the internet. So rather than just see things bouncing back and forth the way they have the last couple of weeks, we thought it would be very fun and very educational to just invite Ken here and get his opinion so that we can learn more about Ken, more about ADTI, and why he feels the way he does. And, of course, also joining us for this segment tonight will be Eric Raymond. So, first of all, Ken, welcome to the Linux Show, first-time guest on the Linux Show.
Great.
Always great to have a new guest. But first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit about ADTI? How long has ADTI existed? You know, what is the focus of ADTI been for the last couple of years? Just tell us a little bit about the emphasis behind ADTI.
Yeah, well, sure. First, let me say that I'm really excited that, you guys thought about having me on, and I think what you're doing is excellent. It's, I've been reading about your show, and I think you're doing a great job, so I want to congratulate you on your show. ADTI is a research foundation. I'm not the founder. I joined ADTI about 6 years ago, almost 7 years ago, and the founder, it was founded in California. Originally, it started out dealing with defense issues, immigration issues, education policy issues. The foundation still focuses on many of those discussions. When I joined, the internet was just starting to, kind of heat up as a public policy discussion. Obviously, it was, always been a technology discussion for quite a while, but as a public policy debate, it just started heating up. And when I got involved in it, one of the first issues we started looking at was export control policy and high-speed chips. And from there, the board decided that, we'd focus a little bit more on domestic technology policy. Most of the technology issues we've done had to do with defense. Since, I kind of brought a lot of the ideas and the energy behind a domestic technology program, I became the director of the technology program. And like some of the other programs we have, education, immigration, defense, the technology policy program is dedicated to looking at ways that, we can impact public policy decision around the country.
Okay. And let's directly address the, and correct me on the pronunciation of the document itself. Is it Samizdat or Samizdat? What is
it? Yeah, the paper that we just published, Samizdat, is Russian. It's a Russian term. And it's interesting, actually Eric can probably comment on this as much as I can, but the term Samizdat was something that was more or less adopted by folks in the open source community to describe the early exchange, however Eric or other folks decided to describe it, of Unix code in the 70s.
No, actually, it was more specific than that.
Right. Well, actually,
we only applied the term Samizdat to publishing the Lyons book. We didn't use that to describe the exchange of source code.
Well, however you want to describe it, but in your jargon dictionary, it does talk about, the term Samizdat, the origin of Samizdat, and I have to credit Eric on the name and the idea.
Okay. Dealing with the document itself, There's a lot of commentary that has been posted out on the internet discussing some of the assertions, some of the commentaries that you've made on the ADTI site about the Samizdat within the Samizdat paper. How did you? What was your procedure for researching the information prior to you making your comments?
Well, just a little background. I mean, I work on a lot of tech issues. I love tech. I'm pro open source. You know, I've worked on all kinds of stuff. You know, everything from like internet export controls and chips to privacy to you know, I'm a big proponent of R&D. And I had written a paper a couple years ago about open source, entitled "Opening the Open Source Debate." And you know, I wrote it basically to talk about the differences in the licensing and how I thought, well, you know, the licensing really was the one distinguishing thing that was going to drive adoption. And I just got this incredible, I mean, this deluge of commentary and people, you know, just really hitting the wall about it, because within the paper there was a chapter on security, and basically what I had done was I had interviewed quite a few security folks and folks that were interested in in talking about ways that systems were compromised, and these folks had insisted to me that if you know more about a system, then you have a better advantage, you have more opportunity to exploit a system.
Did anyone ever explain Kirchhoff's law to you?
Who's that? Eric Raymond. Did anyone ever explain Kirchhoff's law to you? Sure. I've heard a lot of theories about this, Eric, and realize, he's just asking for background on how I got interested in the topic.
Yeah.
And what I did was I looked at this strictly from the standpoint of as an observer. I have never cracked a software in my life, and that's not what I do. I just look at this thing strictly from a public policy standpoint. And when folks told me that, hey, listen, you know, if I know, you know, what time you get into your office in the morning versus what time you leave at night, that's valuable information to exploit a system. I mean, anything that I know about your system is very, very valuable. And when folks went as far as telling me that the architecture, the design, programming specs, all that information was pretty much disclosed in open source, it just seemed to me, you know, pretty logical that if I were interested in exploiting a system, an open source system would provide a considerable amount of information. So anyway, what happened was, just to wrap this up, I got, you know, a lot of reports and a lot of retorts about, you know, my conclusion that, you know, open source wasn't secure. And I was just a bit puzzled about one thing more than another, and that was the repetition that source code was irrelevant. That, you know, whether you have code or not is irrelevant. If, you know, you can, you know, freely exchange code, it's no real big deal. And I read this, about Samizdat. I had read about this issue of the Unix code, and I hadn't even heard of Samizdat. I hadn't even heard of the Lion's book, and I was reading this, and I said, well, wait a minute. You know, a couple of years ago when I was working on this topic, folks insisted that, you know, basically, you know, you can't compromise the system necessarily because you have source code.
I understand your story here.
Yes, sir.
I have to ask you a question. Who was claiming that source code was irrelevant?
I got like hundreds of comments from people emailing me saying that, Ken, if I have source code to your system, it doesn't necessarily mean that it makes it insecure. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's less secure than another system. The source code is basically irrelevant as a security feature. That's what people were telling me. Okay? Now, moving forward, I'd read about this incident, and just to wrap this up pretty quickly in two sentences or less, I didn't understand how in the world people could say, you know, argue, well, this Unix code was so valuable that it had to be exchanged all over the place, that it had to be photocopied basically illegally, but the code was irrelevant. If the code was, the code didn't have any real value, then it seemed to me that there'd be, you know, there'd be no need to copy it and to, you know, to exchange it freely. So that's when I kind of got interested in the whole thing and revisiting the question of the value of source code, and it kind of transitioned me into the whole intellectual property, you know, evaluation of, you know, perspectives and values with regards to, you know, how source code is used. And I concluded basically the same thing, that, you know, this whole software industry really, in my opinion, drills down into value, and source code is incredibly valuable.
Okay, I'm beginning to understand a couple things better. You heard two things. You heard two different things, Ken, which I think you managed to misinterpret, and maybe this isn't your fault because you don't have you didn't have the right technical background.
Sure.
But you heard people saying that the possession of source code was irrelevant to whether a system was less secure or not.
Right.
The clause you were missing is that's only true if the security design is good. If the security design of a system is correct, it doesn't matter whether the attacker has source code or not. A correctly designed security system doesn't depend on the security of its methods, only of its keys, only of its passwords or password equivalents. If, on the other hand, you have a badly designed system, such that it depends on the secrecy of its methods and not just of its keys, then the attacker having source codes can be relevant.
Well, so, you know, this is what's interesting about this conversation. And again,
yes,
you know, I really appreciate, you know, the time to talk with you and any of your listeners. But a lot of this the issue of you know, source code and the value of it and to an attacker. I was reading some of Schneier's work. Is that how you pronounce his name, Bruce Schneier?
Schneier.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, basically, a lot of his argumentation, from what I've been able to see, has been pretty much extrapolated, and I won't say misinterpreted, but his argument basically for source code, you know, availability was basically around peer review, which suggested,
yeah,
that, like, you're a good guy, you know, Eric's a good guy, some people in your audience are good guys, and it's a great idea for them to have the source code so they can improve it. But in no way at all is he suggesting that if somebody from the Al-Qaeda or somebody that has bad intentions to have the source code, is that a good idea?
Ken, I can put this very simply.
Sure.
If the source code is closed, only the bad guys get to see the bugs. If it's open, the good guys may get to see them too.
Right. Listen, gentlemen, I am not... I debated that security issue to death, and, you know, I published what I thought, but I'm not going to tell you that you don't have a point that, you know, that's defendable. I think you have a very defendable point. But, you know, again, like I said, going back to some of the stuff that Schneier was writing, most of it talked about peer review. It didn't talk about just any Tom, Dick, and Harry having access to the source code.
Anybody. But the thing is, peer review means everybody has access.
That peer review means peers. It doesn't mean
everybody. Well, I mean, but, you know, anybody can be a peer. We don't.
Well, that's not what it is.
Being a software developer is not an exclusive club.
But if you read what he's writing, it's strictly for people that, you know, are friendly, people that are interested in improving code. It's not just, okay, I'm going to give it to anybody.
But Mr. Brown, not anybody has access to make updates to the code. The only people that have access to the code are those people that are trusted, those trusted peers. But anybody can suggest updates to the code. I mean, I could submit an update to the Linux kernel, but I've never submitted an update to the Linux kernel before. So my submission would not be trusted right away. There would be peer review on it. The regular kernel developers would have to review my changes and to approve it. And then, of course, Linus will have to do it, too. And he'll have to look and say, okay, this is a good good fix or a bad fix. And see, so the peer review is there even though I'm not one of the anointed few that can change the code.
And there's an even more fundamental point, which is in the world of software, you can't tell who your peers are in advance. Credentials don't mean a lot. So in order to get
a lot of good 15-year-olds out there.
Right. Credentials don't mean a lot. So in order to get the most effective possible peer review, you have to open it to everybody, even 15-year-old kids halfway around the world.
Can I jump in here for a second? I've got to ask kind of question because there was a lot of shock on the IRC, and there's 60-something people out on the IRC right now. And you made a comment very early in the segment where you said that you are a fan of open source software.
That's right.
Okay. I'm not going to beat you up for the comment. I want you to tell us how you define that you're a fan of open source software so we can understand your logic better.
The issue is this, gentlemen, and this is what I pose to you as fair-minded people. If you have the opportunity to better technology, we each take that opportunity, I would assume. If you have the opportunity to better software, you do the same. I think that is part of the process of invention. I mean, it's questionable when invention starts, right? Invention could start with Eric, and then somebody looks at what Eric does and decides they want to improve it. Start with what you do. It can start with anybody. But I think that there is a difference between saying, okay, we're going to produce, all this low-cost technology for everybody to work on, including Eric, and improve and add to, versus saying we're going to put this low-cost software code out there for everybody to improve, but nobody can really, can call it their own private property and leverage it in the marketplace as private property. In my opinion, when you look at the government's model and what the government does for the U.S. and for that matter the entire world, I mean when you invest in R&D, it stimulates markets. There's lots of studies that show that R&D stimulates capital markets, it stimulates investment, it creates jobs, and research and development moves through channels such as colleges, moves through some corporations, moves through consortiums. I mean, like Mosaic was part of a Defense Department initiative, sprung from a Defense Department initiative. But my point is that started with R&D, and then the idea is to give people, really smart people, an incentive to develop technology. So to that extent, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm very much for innovation and improving software, but I don't agree with the model when you're saying that you're going to take incentives away from people to say any improvement that I make to it, I can't own or I cannot market as my own product.
So then you
and I own every piece of software I've ever written. You're confusing a couple of different levels of description here.
Who am I talking with?
This is the other thing.
Okay,
I
great.
Have copyrights. I own every piece of software I've ever written.
Eric, the word own, though, Eric, let's be
clear
about
that. I own every piece of software I have ever written. I have not given up ownership of that software. It is my choice to make that software freely available to others for peer review so that technology will improve. So don't claim that we have a model in which ownership is important. Ownership is critically important to us. It's vital to me that I own my work. It belongs to me, and I'm recognized as the author.
Well, Eric, let's be fair about this, okay? Let's be fair about this. You can go on any open source discussion group list. You can look on the net. You see a lot of programmers out there that are very, very squeamish about the GPL model. That are very pro open source, and I've looked at a lot of these studies, and it shows that the GPL license is basically almost getting carnivorous. I mean, you cannot tell me that you guys are, looking at this thing fairly. I mean, what is wrong with people that say, okay, I want certain types of software to be open source, but I don't want it all to be GPL. Why can't we
that's
have
fine. That's why
independent licenses?
Can? That's why
sure.
That's why so many of the GPL'd software packages also have other licenses.
Right.
Although I license under other licenses.
Can,
GPL is only one of the licenses.
That's right.
And although it's a very good open source,
there's a lot of pressure out there. There seems to be a lot of pressure. I'm observing this as an observer. There's a lot of pressure out there, and as far as I'm concerned, some of it's almost intimidating to developers to GPL their software. And I just
there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, I have a problem with that.
Directly. I can address this directly.
Sure.
Ken, I am the president of the body that the Open Source Initiative, which is the organization that certifies licenses as open source. We are the people who corporations come to when they want to write a new open source license and have it certified kosher for use by the community. And we are the people that the developers trust to say, this is an open source license and it's safe to play with. Okay? So I know a great deal about the distribution of licenses, which licenses are being used for what, and what the social pressures on people are. Would you like to hear about that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's an important discussion.
Okay. So I'll start with a simple statistic. I have done several different studies on the distribution of licenses since 1998, and I've consistently found that the GPL has about 50% share, that is approximately half of the open source projects out there are issued under GPL, and half of them are issued under other licenses. The other license with the largest share is the Berkeley Unix Systems license and its variants. The share on that license is around 20%. And the other 30% is divided up among a lot of different other licenses, including the Apache license, the Perl license, various open source licenses that are particular to individual projects like the Mozilla license. So right now, OSI has certified approximately 40 licenses. The GPL is the most popular at 50%, but the rest of the market, if you will, is divided up among approximately a dozen significant licenses, and the rest are noise. Okay, this doesn't sound to me like an environment in which anyone is getting pressured.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've got a study online that I downloaded, and you guys have to forgive me. I talked to so many people. I can't remember the gentleman who did this study. I think of his name probably 15 minutes later. But he basically reported that it's more incongruent than that. That GPL open source is almost 80% of all open source.
He's wrong. You can go check. The way to go check is if you go to Fresh Meat or SourceForge, it's
sure.
possible to get reports on projects broken down by license types. And
right.
you don't have to trust my conclusions. You can go look for yourself. You'll find.
Well, I guess this is where we are. I mean, I'm not disputing what you're saying. I was alarmed when I saw this other report, but I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, if we're going to really call this an open source community, I would just tell you that I think that it's important that folks are, you know, stop feeling so much pressure to, you know, to GPL their code. I think that's wrong.
So as no developer, I have never experienced any pressure whatsoever to GPL my code. Now,
okay.
Furthermore, I don't know anyone who's experienced pressure to GPL their code. And as a person who used GPL for some of my projects and not non-GPL licenses for others, frankly, I find the thought of that anyone could ever pressure me to do one or the other absurd. It's ridiculous.
Well, you know what? It's Ken Brown making stuff up, but if you'd like me to send you a couple quotes here and there from folks, you know, I can tell you guys one thing. I'm in Washington, D.C., and I love policy and I love politics. And, you know, I mean, I just have to tell you guys that, you know, you've got a bit of a politic there, because there's just too many people that I've talked to in person, 6 inches from my nose, that are saying that, you know, folks have just gotten a little, very aggressive about the licensing of code out there. Now, there are people out there that aren't, they're not Tim Brown, they're not going to stand up and say, you know, I have an opinion about this because they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to get in a flame fest. So all I can say is not to speak up for folks that aren't speaking up, because there are, you and I both know that there are people that have problems with the GPL. I mean, if we're going to be honest about it, there are people that are in the open source community that disagree with it. So all I'm saying is I think that when we talk about open source, we need to talk about it across the board, across BSD, across the MIT license. Apache is very successful across its licensing paradigm. And I think that's what open source is about. That's my opinion.
What actual evidence do you have that anybody who didn't want to GPL their code has been forced to do so?
I'd
like to take that further than that. Ken, honestly, this is Jeff Garrard.
Sure.
I would like to see one case of a company that was, or a company or an individual that was forced to GPL their code.
Okay.
Honestly, you know, and you don't have to do this minute. You know, you can email it to me, and I will post it on our site. But I am unaware of a single case that a company has been forced to GPL their code.
Wait a minute. I never said anybody was forced to. What I said was people feel an unusual amount of pressure. I've talked to individual developers about it. I've seen it on a lot of the boards. And I see a lot of pressure out there, a lot of very, very aggressive activities out there to move the GPL forward and move it further ahead of the other licenses. If you guys are saying I'm imagining it, then that's fine.
The comments you're probably seeing really fall more in the classification of people whining about the price of gasoline. Sure, you know.
Why is that whining? I don't understand. The point is, gentlemen, that the GPL is a relatively new license. I mean, these other licenses have been around before the GPL.
GPL was initiated in the 1970s by Richard Stallman.
Most of the other open source.
Well, I love it wasn't the 1970s. It was not 1970s.
That's when the Free Software Foundation was founded, and that's where it came.
It was simply after that, and these other licenses have been around before that license, and I just think it's important. I'm not a guy to quibble about stuff, but I just think it's important that we talk about open source. Open source should be what everybody wants it to be. It shouldn't necessarily all be GPL. That's all I'm saying.
Well, no one says that.
The community has an argument with you about that.
Sure. Okay.
We use 34 different actually 40 different licenses at last count, and 12 of them have significant market share. Nobody is out there holding a gun to somebody's head and saying you've got a GPL. The idea is ridiculous.
The idea is ridiculous. Nevertheless, I'm just mentioning taking the time to articulate you had a question. What was my opinion? And I'm giving you my opinion. My opinion is open source should be all licenses, and when we talk about open source, it should be across the entire spectrum. I am not pro-GPL, but I am pro-open source. That's all I'm saying.
I'd like to move the direction off to another comment that you made about the economic model of open technology. And I'm specifically using open technology because I want to encompass hardware in this because of a comment you made. First thing is I'm going to ask you a question that I already know the answer for. And the question is, you stated that there's a lot of people who don't see profitability in open technologies in open source. If that's the case, why is IBM, HP, Novell collectively spent $1.4 billion in the last fiscal year on developing open technology? If there was no profit.
I think that's a very poignant question.
That is a poignant question.
And let me give you my answer to that. I haven't seen IBM make a dime on any of their investment in Linux. I've looked at the numbers. I think it's basically a kill Bill strategy. It can be an effective kill Bill strategy. I mean, it could work. It could work.
You don't consider they make a huge amount of money on their Linux development. You know how? They sell Linux servers. They sell machines that are enabled by Linux and that have more value because Linux is on them.
They also service Linux machines and also service software.
But gentlemen, you guys, your host asked me a very specific question.
Yeah.
He asked me about profit, not revenue. He didn't ask me about cost. He didn't ask me about advertising.
Right.
He asked me about profit. And there is no profit across any of the Linux investment by IBM right now. No profit. They're operating at a loss.
They think they're making a profit.
I think that's lovely. I mean, Pets.com thought they were making a profit too. I don't see it. I was looking at Red Hat stock today. Red Hat stock is really getting hammered right now.
Red Hat stock was hammered because of some accounting discrepancies, and everyone knows that the market reacts badly in this post-Enron world to any kind of accounting discrepancy.
Well, all I'm saying is, gentlemen...
No, please don't interrupt. I don't think you can come around and say this one day is indicative of a stock trend for Red Hat.
You asked me a question about profits.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen any profits. I mean, if you guys want to show me profits, I'd be happy to talk about it.
Seeing huge profits from its Linux investment.
They made their $2 billion investment into Linux. They reported a year ago that they had made all that money back. And I can't imagine that in that, year since they made that announcement that they have, stopped making any money.
Well, I'll tell you guys something. I'll buy everybody dinner. Everybody dinner if you can prove that to me, because I've looked at it and it's completely unsubstantiated that they've made any money back on their Linux investment in a year. And if you guys want to take me up on that, I'll fly out to California or wherever and I'll buy you dinner. But IBM has not made a profit on their Linux investment.
Okay, man, there's a great Thai restaurant in Georgetown. I'm going to throw you up on that. I'm so there.
So here's the deal. If I can get Dan Fry,
yeah, that's who I was thinking of too.
Okay, if I can get Dan Fry to hand me the evidence that I can forward to you, you will buy us all dinner.
I will buy you guys dinner. because it would be news to me and about three analysts I've had that looked at it. Okay, that whole Munich play, okay, was a huge expense. IBM is, they're a smart company.
Yeah.
And they're spending money to go after these accounts, from Microsoft. And I think it's smart.
IBM wasn't involved in the Munich thing. That was all SUSE.
Well, I don't know what you guys are reading, but like I said, you guys show me the numbers and we can, we can have dinner. Matter of fact, we can have dinner either way. I just won't be paying for it, but. But if you guys can prove to me that IBM is making some money on some of these deals, yeah, I'd be happy to buy you dinner.
Okay, because Red Hat has been profitable for, 2 years now? Yeah, but we're trying to...
Red Hat is not profitable.
What?
Red Hat is not profitable.
Profit to the SEC.
Well, I don't know what numbers you guys are looking at, but Red Hat is not profitable.
We're looking at their 10-Ks.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Let's the next time we talk, let's talk about Red Hat profitability and IBM profit on Linux. I mean, I'd be happy to get the numbers in front of us, and I can have a friend or two that are analysts on the line with me, and we can go through the sheets. We can go through the spreadsheets. But, from what I'm told, it's not profitable. We can go over the numbers. I mean, I'm objective. I want to hear what you guys have to say about it.
I actually have a question, and I'd like to step back from this. This is Brian Prophet from Linux Today, Mr. Brown. I guess my big question here, and this is more big picture than anything we've dealt with, is that even if your assertions about IBM and Red Hat and the open source model not being profitable are true, what harm is that to the individual customers that are going to be using this technology? If IBM wants to, as you say, sink their money into this, where's the harm? You know,
I think it's a great idea when you're talking about an academic environment. You're talking about R&D. Mm-hmm. You're talking about an environment that does not have to return profits. Second, my biggest concern is what, you know, the host raised earlier. I mean, I have a real concern, gentlemen, about somebody substantiating to me empirically, not just with a lot of happy talk, substantiating to me empirically that you can reverse the intellectual property model and make money in the IT industry. I think intellectual property is the key to the IT industry. If you look at all the numbers, some of the studies that have come out of Washington, I mean, they all point to the fact that almost every single S&P company right now, you know, the value of these companies is hinged to intellectual property. So now you have a model, and you guys want me to kind of, you know, go along with this thing because it sounds great, that basically says, well, you know, Red Hat is basically a non-IP value company, and it's going to make money. IBM, which makes almost $1 billion a year in license fees on its own intellectual property, is out there telling everybody that they don't need to own any software. It should all be free. I mean, it's specious to me. And let me ask you something else, Mr. Prophet.
Sure.
Let me ask you something else. And this is something that I'd like you to speak to as far as the character of this whole pitch. Now,
okay.
IBM is selling WebSphere, right?
Right.
The IBM walks into an account and says, now, you shouldn't have to pay for an operating system, right? But you should pay for WebSphere. Meanwhile, there are guys out there, from what I understand, that are building a comparable WebSphere product that's open source.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that sound, I mean, you know, characteristically inconsistent to argue that, well, you should buy my software, but you shouldn't buy, you know, you shouldn't buy his software. Or if my open source is better than his closed source, but, you know, you shouldn't buy his closed source because it's not open. I mean, don't you see the inconsistency in this whole thing? If IBM truly was an open source proponent, you know, why are they competing with open source products? Why are they still selling their own closed products?
There's nothing wrong with selling closed source products with open source.
It's called
leverage.
That's basically what I would have answered, which would have been, they've been selling WebSphere alongside of their other products.
And Red Hat leverages their free Linux by adding their tools, and SUSE adds their tools, and it's all about leverage.
Yeah, weird idea that we're against markets, but we're not. We like markets just fine.
I mean, we're capitalists. I mean, most of the free software community are a bunch of libertarians.
I will tell you this. In answer to your question, I mean, and I'll shut my mouth and I'll say, hey, listen, you know, I'm pro IP across the board. I don't see how a model that says, hey, listen, you know, we shouldn't have ownership of intellectual property. I don't see how, gentlemen, it coexists with an intellectual property.
Nobody said that no one should own the intellectual property. As Eric clearly stated earlier, he owns the copyright of every software he's written. There is intellectual property with free software, and even under the GPL. In fact, the GPL requires that the software be copyrighted.
Well,
okay.
It's reversed. What I'm saying is this, okay? And I'm trying to be as succinct as possible, and I appreciate you guys, you know, taking the time to talk with me about this.
Well, we appreciate you being here.
I want to be clear. Look, I don't believe that they can coexist, gentlemen. I don't see it coexisting. I think IBM is going to pull the rug out.
But it does coexist.
You know what? It's coexisting. It's going to coexist for a little while longer.
Taking over the whole industry.
I don't think it's going to work. And so that's my prediction. And I guess, you know, I'll take egg in the face until I'm right. But I don't see it coexisting. I don't see it working.
Did we have Rob Limo come in?
I'm right.
Rob Limo.
Holy
Rob Limo.
Holy
Hey, Ken, how are you? We had lunch a couple of years ago in D.C.
Yeah, I remember that.
This is great. Yeah, I've been enjoying this. You've ATDI has certainly advanced quite a ways from the days saying secondhand smoke is good for you and all that.
Hey, man, you know.
I read all of those studies. They're wonderful. So how the heck are you these days? Want to come down and move to Florida where we live now?
I was in Tampa a few days ago. I love it down there. Great
place. Come down here. I'm in the middle of Catherine Harris's congressional district. You'd like it. Anyway, you're a good advocate and all that. I think you do your job. You do it very, very well. And I've met, as you know, in my time as a reporter in D.C., I've met lots and lots of people in that business. If I could convince either my company or the OSDL or a consortium or the OSI with some donations to hire you as our lobbyist, how much would you need?
Man, let me tell you. Since everybody in the show is a capitalist, I'd be happy to shoot down here, guys, and talk to you about it. I mean, we're all capitalists together.
Right now what you're doing is restating what Mr. Ballmer at Microsoft says. And you know that I have friends who work there, including in PR and such, and some of them are actually kind of embarrassed by you right now. Why don't we hire you and get you some real information, my friend, and give you something that's true that you can advocate? Would you?
Well, I'll tell you something. From a man that's, you know, made money in the limo business and the software business, and, you know, hey, listen, I'm open to your ideas. I'm open to your ideas, and, you know, you're not missing any meals. I remember when we had lunch, you know, you ate all the food we bought you, and, you know.
And
I'd be happy to listen to you, Rob.
I said thank you, my friend.
Well, like I said, I mean, you know, you're not missing any meals. And if you want to talk, I mean, anytime.
I would love to see, I'd like to put you together with Stallman, you know, at the Free Software Foundation, who I think has some great ideas.
Oh my gosh, they would annihilate each other in a flare of purple gamma rays.
You know what? I respect Richard Stallman. He's a purist. He's sticking with what he believes in.
Tenfold.
He started with it. He started with an idea. It was his idea. He's a smart guy, but more importantly, what I like about Richard Stallman is, I mean, he's true to technology. He's true to science. He's not out trying to be a populist. He's not trying to appeal to everybody.
That's for sure.
I respect Richard Stallman. I got a lot of respect for Richard Stallman. I don't have respect for people that, you know, are out there, you know, jamming on that man as hard as they are when they're using a lot of his work. Where would Linux be without Richard Stallman?
It wouldn't exist.
There wouldn't be anything. It would be just a kernel.
Why don't we get you?
And I tell you, just like I imagine that people put pressure on one another out there in the GPL software, I'm probably imagining that people out there, really undermine a lot of Richard Stallman's work. And I think that's kind of unfortunate. I think it's a real black mark on a lot of folks out there, in my opinion.
The GPL, all that GPL accomplishes in the open source, when the main thing that GPL accomplishes is protects our software base from being co-opted and taken and put behind a steel wall. And that's important to the open source community because we have developed the software as a collaborative effort of thousands of programmers, and we don't want that effort to be taken and wrapped up behind in a box. We want both the technology and the software to remain open. Now, is the GPL the sole license? No, it is not. Is it the only license? No, it is not. But it is one way that we can protect the intellectual property of the open source community to make sure that it remains open. And that is the main thing that the GPL does, and that's very important to us.
Listen, I respect that, and all I'm asking you guys to do is this. I respect what you're saying, and I respect what you're trying to do, and I definitely respect all the work that you put into what you've built, all right? I mean, I respect that. But what I'm asking you guys to consider for a minute is, now we're talking about this idea, okay, intersecting, encountering, whatever term you want to use, a proprietary world and a proprietary model, which I've observed.
Let me finish. The answer for you.
I've observed does not mix well. I think it's basically phosphorus and water. I don't think it's going to work.
Okay.
But I respect what you guys are trying to do.
I
respect it.
Wait. Ken, I'd like to ask you to respond to a couple comments.
Yeah, sure.
That specifically address that.
Sure.
Okay. Number one, do you see any value in a public domain?
Absolutely.
Okay. Number two, do you see the benefit to the economy when manufacturing raw materials become commoditized?
What do you mean specifically? Like if I dig aluminum out of the ground?
When raw materials are cheap. Is that good for the economy when raw materials are cheap?
Well, I see where you're going. I'm not trying to jump your question.
Should I pay a dollar a pound for nails, or should I pay $500 a pound for nails? I mean,
listen, like we said, we're all capitalists here. We all want to get as much as we can for everything. I agree with what you're saying.
Ken, you are really ignoring the issue. The problem that the Fed, driven by Microsoft, in the quote-unquote IP requirement for the IT industry is completely specious, because commoditization has always been good for the American economy. Always. There's not a single case in the history of the United States free market that you can show me when commoditization wasn't good, when it didn't create jobs, when it didn't expand industries. And that's all that's happening with open technology. If raw materials are getting cheaper, more companies can get into the technology business, people can make cheap TiVos, things like that, it's good for the economy. Is it not?
Well, I disagree. I'm not sending you to hell because I disagree. I just disagree. I think that when you look at cars, for instance, I would argue that a car, even though 90% of the materials are commoditized, 90% of the value in a car is probably its intellectual property. All right? And I just think that, you're going to go bankrupt in the car industry, not because you can't get products cheap enough, but because you can't, because you're not competitive, because you don't have differentiation. And differentiation starts with IP. So that's
Mr. Brown, when I work on my car, I can go to Sears and buy a tool set, and it will work on any single car in the world.
That's right.
Okay? That's the problem.
But you also protect your ownership, all right, of that process, of that car, and you dictate terms, and you get fees and licenses so that people can build tools to work on that car.
That's right, but I don't have to buy a special tool set for each different brand of car. Every single car uses the same standard.
That's right.
Okay, and that's what open source is all about. It's about having a software standard where anybody can work on their car.
I have a specific question.
And as a matter of fact, the actual value in the auto industry, it's interesting that you picked that example, Ken, because the actual value in the car industry is not, in fact, in the intellectual property. Most of it is simply in being able to amass the required capital to buy the machine tooling to manufacture the cars.
I completely disagree with you there. As a matter of fact, the paper that I'm working on right now, where I'm interviewing a lot of manufacturers, folks across the manufacturing industry that completely disagree with you guys. Almost all differentiation in manufacturing is based on processes, guys. And that's how they're able to make their profit. And they keep those processes secret, and they keep those processes to themselves so they can preserve their position in the marketplace.
How is that inconsistent with what I just said? You're talking about maintaining processes that they can.
Right. Those are patents. Those are patents. Yes. Those are patents.
Right.
It's IP.
Okay. But that doesn't mean that the designs of the cars are secret.
The way you make the car is the profit. That's the profit. It's the way you do it.
Yeah, car manufacturers make money by making the cars cheaper and for cost and cost savings, and the better they can do that, and the consistent with the value of the car, the more money they make, and that's just simple economics, though. I mean, it's just simple economics.
Right.
This is first semester economics.
Ken, if the car industry had to pay an intellectual property patent or license fee for every bolt or every screw they had to put into a car, an automobile today, your cheap automobiles would be around $100,000.
Well, gentlemen, like I said, I mean, you can take a look at take a look at some of the comments I've got from manufacturers in the automobile industry, and you can call up and tell them they're wrong. But I mean, they're telling me that you're wrong.
Right.
That patents drive almost every single manufacturing, every single process in manufacturing a car is from patents. I mean, almost every one of them. So, I mean, I know you guys, want me to tell me to say I'm wrong, but I haven't observed that I'm wrong, but I mean, that's fine. I mean,
You're confusing a couple of different issues here.
Well, what am I confusing? I said patents three times. What am I confusing?
Because you're confusing two different kinds of patents. Okay?
Okay.
The thing that is parallel to open source in automobiles is the fact that we don't have to buy special tools to open the hood and fix the engine. The fact that the manufacturing processes are patented and proprietary is a different issue.
And it's irrelevant.
Wait a minute, gentlemen. Why is that irrelevant when you're telling me that your process is open so I can see exactly how you built the software?
Because in software, unlike material goods, software is unlike material manufacturing in that the process and the product merge. They merge because it's all bits.
Right. But if I were to reverse engineer a car, gentlemen, which you guys do quite a bit in the software business, no names mentioned, right? What protects me as Ford? What protects me as Chrysler? Even if you did reverse engineer it, would be the patent. I could prove that you stole my process, because I could go back and match my patented process versus what you did.
Yes.
So I just disagree. I think that the differentiation is from the patent, which protects both processes, and it protects lots of things. I just disagree.
Ken, I could still make a wheel. I could still make a drive shaft. I could still make an axle. I could still manufacture a body without paying anybody intellectual property fees.
Right.
You can make your own car.
I can make my own car if I want to.
You can make your own car if you want to, but all I'm saying is that these corporations value their patents because what they told me and what I've observed is that is the differentiation which allows them, which gives them a position of profit in the marketplace.
Yeah, but you know what, Ken?
Sure.
Those same companies are starting to use enormous amounts of open source technology to build their automobiles.
Well, this is what's been fun about this conversation. This is what's been fun about this conversation, because it all goes back to something that, I was mentioning earlier today. I think it was Mr. Prophet was asking me what I thought about all this. I don't think these two models can coexist. So that's really where you guys will say, hey, Ken, you're completely wrong. You'll show me that they can. But I don't see corporations and a lot of these folks, walking away from intellectual property rights. And it's interesting that this is all juxtaposed with a lot of discussion out there about, hey, listen, we should get rid of process patents, we should get rid of this patent, that patent. We don't need all these rights, and it's just driving up the cost of everything. So I guess we just have to wait and see, and, hey, I'm just one guy. I mean, I have my opinions, but, I'm just one guy.
Let me give you an example, something to consider. Not something to maybe discuss in depth at this point, but something to consider. Consider the mess that instant messaging is in right now.
Mm-hmm.
With everybody trying to carve out their own proprietary niche, all right? Now, if that had happened to the telephone system in the early 20th century, no one would be able to talk to one another on the telephone, all right? Open standards and open technology is the way is the way innovation proceeds.
That's actually a really bad example.
Well,
that's,
I mean, it's the only one I could think of at the time. Give me a better one, Eric.
Give him a break. I know what he's trying to say. Give him a break.
It was a really bad example because that particular standard was imposed by government fiat.
Yeah, well, okay.
It was
but
imposed at the point of a gun.
You know what, you guys, guess what, though? As a matter of trivia, you know Alexander Graham Bell defended his patent almost 200 times inside of, 14, 16 years?
That's right.
I mean, 200 times, guys.
The patent expired for 17 years.
To say that they invented the telephone. I mean, it all kind of goes in a circle. I kind of like the example because,
but without open standards, in the competitive marketplace, without open standards, the innovation doesn't work because basically now we've got several different messaging standards and none of them can, and everybody's at war with one another and no one, and guess what? No one's able to talk to everybody.
That doesn't work. I tell you something, guys. Look, I think that open source works particularly because scientists can all come together. It works great in government. I mean, we're working on a space shuttle. We're working on a laboratory or something in outer space. We need more scientists. We need more help. We don't have the money. And I think this whole open model is science in its purest sense. But we need to come up with, like you say, something that's efficient, that works, that makes sense, and that we can get going right away. I, for one, would love to talk to you guys about, what can we do to get NASA jump started? I mean, heck, I thought when I was, 7 years old, we'd be, doing interplanetary exploration by now. We're not doing it. And I'd like to see more science, not less. And I think it's terrible what's going on with these probes on Mars. And, I don't understand why we can't get our programs, all linked up. And then we could explore space faster. But getting down to the bones of this thing, the nitty-gritty, so to speak, I just have a problem, gentlemen, trying to see how that same model that I'm talking about working in a private sector, capitalistic, greedy, bunch of, Rob Limos out there. It's people are business people. They're tough-minded. I mean, I don't see that cooperativeness working.
Mr. Brown,
have you read The Magic Cauldron?
We don't have time, Robin. We've only got a couple more minutes.
Go ahead, Rob.
Here's the question, Ken. Specifically in your Samistat piece, you mentioned Prentice Hall and their copyrights for Linux or Unix and being violated.
No, it was Minix. It was Minix. Rob, Minix.
Right. And about how they should be jumping on Linux.
No, I never said that. Didn't say that, though, Rob.
Well, I can send you your quote.
I didn't say that, Rob. But go ahead.
Violation of copyright.
Didn't say that, Rob. I didn't say violation.
Hold on. Let Rob have a say. Let him ask a question. Go ahead, Rob.
My question here is if they should be upset, even about Minix, which you're now saying you didn't say, I'm wondering why they are, at this very moment, paying me money to write a Linux book, and I'm not the only one. You'd mentioned Prentice Hall as somebody who's had ownership of Minix and should be upset, and yet I see them jumping hard onto the Linux bandwagon and profiting heavily from it, as am I personally, and I'll admit it. So,
this is the reason why I'm very stick with you about this, because I wrote something, I stand by what I wrote, but a lot of people didn't read what I wrote. But let me be very, very specific, Rob. First of all, I heard you, but let me answer the question. Let me be very specific. I introduced the Minix discussion in Prentice Hall as a metaphor about attribution and about acknowledgement and about being, and understanding the business model with regard and with respect to software development. You cannot say just because I didn't copy code or just because I didn't use code word for word, that excuses you from attribution. That excuses you from acknowledging where you got it from. And I introduced the Minix discussion. Rob, let me finish. I introduced the Minix discussion because Prentice Hall was selling books, right? And they were making money, okay? Just like they're making money with the Linux book, they're making money selling a book on Linux. And in my and from what I read, okay, what happened was when they say when you say I'm going to sell Linux software in the book, they own the rights to the software, but more importantly, they're only using the software to sell more books. And I thought that it was very interesting that what happened was you introduced this new product called Linux, which discourages people from even buying the books now. Nobody needs to buy the Linux book because the whole idea was, hey, if you buy the Linux book, it costs $125 because I got to get a piece of it to guys like Rob who write the book. But now you introduce this new product, and you don't have to buy the book anymore.
Yeah, you do. If you want to, if you're interested in finding out about microkernels, you want to look at the Linux book because Linux is a microkernel. Linux is not a microkernel.
If you look on the Linux, if you look on the OS discussion board, the board
Reddit, comp.os,
you look on the board, you'll see the correlation between all the discussion about people being pissed off that they had to pay for the book, and then this software pops up. It doesn't owe any attribution at all to Linux, and guess what, guys? You can have the code. You don't have to buy the book to get the code. You see in their comments all over the board that speaks specifically to that you do not have to buy the book. That's the point I was making, Rob.
Just to clarify my own mind, this is Russ Pavlicek. Just to clarify my own mind what I'm saying, are you saying that essentially then Prentice Hall is making less money selling Linux books than they were selling Linux books with software?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that if I'm selling a book, right?
Right.
I have a book, and then part of the hook to buy the book is you get the software, right?
Mm-hmm.
But everybody wants the software out there, right?
Right.
Everybody wants the software. They don't want to pay for the book. They just want the software.
Paul
wants you to buy both, right?
So now you have people who aren't paying for the software, and there are books out there. And are you saying that they're not buying Linux books?
No, Linux is irrelevant. We're talking about Linux. The Linux book, the original Linux book, right?
No. Let's go back to profit. You know, that's where we started, right? You wanted to talk about profit.
Right.
You wanted to talk about generation of profit. Now, you had the Linux book with the Linux software, and you had profit associated with that, supposedly, I assume.
Right.
And then you have the same company, which now supposedly has been stripped of this valuable intellectual property.
No, wait a minute.
They're not making money off of it because now Linux is for free, and now they have to sell Linux books, and
Linux,
somehow they're not making as much profit?
There is nothing wrong with Prentice Hall selling a book about anything. They can sell a book about Washington. That's not my point. My point was, if Rob wants to cut a deal for Prentice Hall, anybody wants to cut a deal with Prentice Hall, I think that's a great thing. I think it's great they're selling books on Linux. But my point in the paper, if you read it very carefully, it says that what happened was people did not want to pay for the book anymore because they only wanted the software. And the Prentice Hall license at that time was very, very restrictive. And how you can get the code. As soon as Tannenbaum lobbied Prentice Hall over the years to change that license, that was no big deal. You could get the software. You could download the software freely. You didn't have to buy the book. But Prentice Hall was making money because people wanted Professor Tannenbaum's software and the book. They wanted both, and you couldn't separate the two.
That's right. You couldn't separate the two, and they made money. Then they separated the two, and lo and behold, they're making more money selling the books without the software than they made with Linux with the software.
I haven't seen that data, but if we can talk about that over dinner too. But you know, I talked to Prentice Hall about sales and. You know, if you have some data showing that they made more money when the software was free, then, you know, hey, I'd love to see it.
Ken, I have a good relationship with those guys. I did a book with them in September, and the book has been extremely successful. It's a book largely aimed at a Linux audience, and I actually talked with my editor about this after the first version of Sound of Doubt came out, and he insists, my editor there, the acquisition editor who bought my book, that Edison Wesley is making far, far more money from Linux books than they ever did from Minix, which was a tiny, tiny little market by comparison. So,
but that's not my point, though. That's not my point. My point is, I'm talking about the Minix book. I'm not talking about Linux books. Minix came with the software. That's what I'm talking about. Specifically, the Minix book, which you can still buy. I think Tanabog had like 4 or 5 versions of it. I'm talking about the Minix book. I'm not talking about Linux books. Of course, they're making more money selling Linux books than Minix books. But here's my other question, and I'll leave you with this. Now, the question of attribution, all right? A lot of people have been going around and around in circles about it. Eric Raymond, you know, he's had some comments about this as well. I mean, does Linux owe any attribution to Minix? I mean, that's
and
my point.
And Tannenbaum says not.
Wait a minute. What is Eric Raymond
actually to the free software?
Okay. You want to hear what I say? Okay? I have looked into the history, okay? There's only one person on the planet who knows more about the history of Unix than I do, and that's Peter Salas. And you should hear what he has to say about this. So I'll tell you what I say. I've looked into this. I've talked to Linus Torvalds. I've exchanged email with Andy Tannenbaum. Andy Tannenbaum says the theory that Linux owes attribution to Minix is ridiculous. Andy Tannenbaum says it's ridiculous. Linus Torvalds says it's ridiculous. I've looked at the code and the history, and I say it's ridiculous. And the only person who knows more about the history of Unix than me, Peter Salas, also says it's ridiculous.
Listen, you can look on Tannenbaum's site. You can look on Tannenbaum's site, and you can look at an interview Tannenbaum just did with a computer magazine, and he says there's traces of Minix in Linux. You can look on Tannenbaum's site also, and he says Linus did a sloppy job with attribution. And you can look in your book, Eric Raymond. You can look in your book, and you say in your own book that Linus got Linux from
Ken,
Minix.
The difference is, we know
what we're talking about.
Ken, the difference is, what Peter and Andy and Linus and I know that you don't is that there is a difference between reusing ideas and stealing code.
Never said so. You know what? You guys, what you guys don't understand about me is that I want to talk about this stuff. I don't just hide in a corner and say something. I never said stole. I never say stole anything. What I said was there was an issue of attribution and appropriation of IP, and I did say very specifically that I had a problem with Torvalds going on and on, that he didn't have any source code, he didn't have anybody's stuff, and he wrote that product from scratch.
And Andrew agrees that that's true.
Tannenbaum, I talk with him, you can look on his site, he tells you very specifically on his site that, listen, that Linus did a sloppy job with attribution.
Okay.
And you can go on and on with this. I mean, Eric, you write it in your own book that's what Linus did. I mean,
and
I don't understand this.
And because you distorted my quote.
How did I distort it? I printed the whole thing. The web guy at my organization was so upset.
Took it out of context and misinterpreted it. You made my quote say something I don't believe.
Eric, you write a whole chapter about this. It's like 5 or 10 paragraphs. I mean, but you're not the only guy. I mean, I interviewed about a dozen people that all said the same thing, that Linus started with Minix to produce Linux. Now, all I'm asking you guys is, gee whiz, while you're beating up on me, all I'm saying is, what's wrong with giving Minix some attribution? What's wrong with saying
that? Because we know the difference. We know the difference between the legitimate reuse of tools and ideas, which is what Linus did, and theft and misattribution, which he did not do.
Never said the word theft. What I'm asking is, hey, listen.
He didn't use the code. He used the idea, Ken.
Okay,
he did not use the code.
What's wrong with saying, hey, listen, I'm going to credit Minix. What's wrong with saying that?
Because he didn't use Minix. He used the Unix standard itself.
Okay. Furthermore,
Ken, he did credit Minix. He credited Minix.
Where's that first email from Torvalds?
Where did he credit Minix in the credit files? Where did he credit Minix?
Ken, he reviewed my paper, my original paper, and when I made the statement about him originally reusing Minix's scaffolding, Linus approved that statement.
Right.
Linus doesn't have a problem with crediting Minix. You're creating a problem where none exists.
Okay. Can I read this? I'm going to read this original quote. This is the original email from Linus Torvalds, August 25th, 1991. And this is posted to the CompOS Minix news group. Hello, everybody out there using Minix. I'm doing a free operating system, just a hobby, won't be big, professional like GNU, for 386, 486 AT clones. This has been brewing since April and starting to get ready. I like any feedback on things people like, dislike in Minix, as my OS resembles it somewhat. Same physical layout of the file system due to practical reasons, among other things. I've currently ported Bash 1.08 and GNU, blah, 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 GCC, blah, 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 and things seem to work. This implies that I'll get some something practical within a few months, and I'd like to know which features most people would want. Blah, 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 blah. Yes, it's free of any Minix code. P.S. Yes, it's free of any Minix code, and it has a multi-threaded file system. It is not portable uses, and it probably never will support anything other than AT hard disks, as that's all I have. Blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
That's the
right,
end of it.
I got that quote in the paper. I mean,
That is his original email.
Now, look at the quote.
He clearly credits Minix as
a
source of ideas.
Do yourself a favor. Go on the ZDNet site, right? Go on the ZDNet site and look at the interview he did right after I released that paper. And then he says, no, it wasn't Minix, it was Unix. Look in the ZDNet interview he does.
But that email took me two seconds to find it with Google, and it's I've read it probably hundreds, dozens of times because I've seen it.
Why does Linus say in this new interview that it wasn't Minix, that it was Unix? Why does he say that?
Listen up.
I can explain that because after he used Minix as an armature to build his original code, he decided that he was going to base the interfaces for the code on published Unix standards. And the reason he did that was because Minix didn't implement enough of what he was interested. So when he says that Linux was based on Unix and not Minix, what he's actually saying is that as his vision for the operating system grew, he realized that it would need to be a full Unix conformant to Unix standards.
Right.
That is not hard to understand, Ken. I understand it, and he understands it. Doug McElroy, one of the original Unix inventors, understands it. Everybody understands it except you.
What I understand is this, gentlemen. This is what I understand, okay? I sat down with all these guys, really smart guys, just like you, Eric, okay? And they all told me, basically, that everybody out there that's writing operating systems starts with somebody's code. Everybody does it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can explain that.
Wait a minute, Eric, hold on, I heard you, okay? Well, Eric, what's the big deal with saying, yeah, I had the Minix code in front of me, and I wrote Linux? What's the big deal with saying that?
Because he didn't. Because he didn't.
Really have a great
page with
he didn't do that.
He didn't do that.
Okay.
Well, everybody can. You're right on one level. Everybody starts with the code, okay?
What did Linus start with? A blank computer screen. Is that what you're saying?
No. Everybody starts with a toolkit. Everybody starts with an editor. Everybody starts with a compiler.
Right.
Everybody starts with an assembler and a set of technical specifications. That's the code they start with.
What about Salas's book? Do they start with Salas's book?
Which book are you speaking of?
With Salas's book. The book he did on Unix. Would they start with that?
Well, Peter Salas's Quarter Century of Unix?
That would be pretty worthless for a program.
No, that would be worthless for an operating system.
The point we're making here is that Linux originally was not a computer operating system. Do you understand that, Ken?
What's that? What you said?
That Linux was not a complete operating system. That it was.
No, I understand. It was just a kernel. I understand that.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure because it's sort of.
No. I understand that. There were two different things between the kernel operating system. I understand that. But
okay.
what I'm saying is this: that what I am not convinced of is just it has zero to do with intellectual property.
an intellectual property case at Parents Hall, and it has more to do with the ramifications of having this commercial model out there where, you know, if you're going to say that you're going to build stuff and you don't have to give, you know, folks attribution or credit, and you don't have to say, well, this is where I got it from, I think that to me, wait a minute, let me finish. I think that to me it's borderline, and I don't really see how you keep a rich intellectual property environment with this type of model.
Yeah,
I mean,
you have been watching the open source community for any length of time and not noticed that we are obsessive about crediting people? Almost every project has a history file, has a credits file that lists people who contributed, lists them by name, lists them by email address, lists them by address. We're obsessive about attributing, we're obsessive about crediting people because that's the currency in our non-monetized economy. That is how we pay each other off, by recognizing each other's works. So far from having a problem with attribution, far from having a problem with credit, we love to do that. That's what knits our community together. And for you to come along and say that we don't do that, that we hide the origins of things, it's obscene, Ken. It's obscene.
I know it's obscene. I know it's obscene. And I know I got my Kleenex out. But the reality is, look, guys, it's a business, and rights and attribution make money. And if you're going to say somebody should have rights to something, in my opinion, again, it juxtaposes this whole idea of free. The OSDL model, to be specific, Eric, is completely different from Richard Stallman's model. Richard Stallman did a good job.
What OSDL model are you speaking of?
I'm speaking of specifically the way you monitor, the way you deal with kernel contributions. Okay, the rights to every line of code is different from the way, as a matter of fact, in Wired magazine this month, they go into this discussion a little bit. I can't remember the article, but I can't remember who wrote it, but in Wired magazine, I think there's an article called The Linux Killer, and there's an article in there specifically about the difference between the way Stallman and Moguln assign rights to every line of code versus the way, you know, Linus does. It's completely different.
Uh-huh.
And I just have to say that I got a problem with, you know, I think that this whole thing really is suspended in midair, basically because what we're hoping and we're all kind of hoping here is that there are no problems with any of this code. There are no problems in everything that comes in, that is exactly what people say it is.
Under the law, Ken.
I think Ken Brown is a waste of time and matters not. Is that possible?
Under the law, Ken, the fact that I contribute code to a project is considered a warrant, considered a representation that I have the right to contribute that code.
Now, Eric, let me ask you a question, Eric. Let's talk about this. You know, let's say, Eric, you work for Sun Microsystems, okay?
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's say you work for IBM, right? You contribute code to Linux.
That's right.
What's the corporate policy? The corporate policy basically is basically anything that you work on that has to do with anything competing with IBM or Sun has to be approved by management, basically, right?
Really, that depends on my employment contract.
Let's talk about that hypothetically, because, you know, I hear folks back there laughing about all this, and I'm interested. I'm trying to understand it. So
okay, then let me ask you, so
you're a Sun employee, right? And you get off work at 6:05, and you start writing code, and you're contributing it. Now, are you free to contribute that code with your employment contract with Sun?
That depends on my employment contract. There are a couple of different cases here. Some people have employment contracts that say that they're assigning the right to any code they write at any time of the day or night to their company. Some other people have employment contracts that specifically recognize that code they write out of working hours belongs to them and they can contribute as they like. There's a third category of people whose employment contract even stipulates that I may spend 25 or 30% of my time at my company in my office working on open source projects, and the code that I do during that time is under my copyright.
Now, has anybody done the research with all this contributed code to find out if all this code is clean? Has anybody done that research?
Sure.
Well, who said sure? Who's done it?
Ken, the answer is we've done exactly as much research as closed source development shops typically do on this question.
Oh, come on. You guys sound like Washington guys now. Come on.
We're talking about the kernel because the open source, the OSRM has gone through the kernel and they say it's clean.
I'll tell you what I read in Wired magazine this month was that the whole process is so questionable that the thing might need to be rewritten from top to bottom. That's what I read.
Nonsense.
Well, okay, it's nonsense. It's nonsense. But I haven't heard anybody out there in the audience say, you know, they looked at a line of code, they looked at a contributor, and they went back to the company that they worked for and said, hey, listen, are you going to claim any rights to this code? Has anybody done that?
That's because if I contribute code to the kernel, I am considered to have made a warrant, a representation that I have the right to do so. And if that turns out not to be the case, the company doesn't have a beef with the kernel developers. It has a beef with me.
That's wrong, my man. That's wrong, my brother. If I sell you a car, right, and you get a receipt, but it's stolen, you've got to give it back. That's wrong.
No. Intellectual property doesn't work quite that way.
Well, you know what? We can all have dinners bought by different people on this one, but you'd have to prove that to me too. Okay? From what I've understood, lawyers I've talked to, they say if you misappropriate copyright, you have to either A, pay for it, or B, destroy it. Same thing.
That's correct.
You can't have it. You can't own something that's not yours, Eric.
Do you know what the duty of mitigation is?
The duty of mitigation? The duty of litigation, you say?
No, mitigation. MITIGATION. The duty of mitigation. Okay.
What's the duty of mitigation?
Ken, I've studied intellectual property law very carefully. I have to because I run an organization that certifies licenses. Okay?
Okay.
So I've studied this whole matter in considerable detail.
Okay.
One of the issues in copyright law is that if you discover that someone else is inadvertently in breach of your copyright, and that would be the case if, for example, I contributed code that I wasn't entitled to contribute to the kernel. Let's say I work for IBM. I contribute code I wasn't entitled to contribute. If IBM then discovers that I have done so, they have a beef with me, but they have a duty called the duty of mitigation to assist the kernel developers in removing the code, not to sue them unless the kernel developers willfully refuse to do so.
Well, fine. I mean, that paper that I wrote, I had a guy call me up and say, hey, Ken, listen, the interviews that you did with two of the CEOs were on my site, and I didn't give you permission to reproduce those interviews that were on my site. But guess what, Ken? If you want to interview those people independently, that's fine. But you need to remove those interviews from your paper. I mean, I agree with you 100%. But you guys, what I'm trying to talk about here is that now we're talking about millions and billions of dollars and hours of work. I mean, you know, this is not a joke. I mean, here I am building a software platform.
Suppose there's a hypothetical situation in which.
Right.
In which I, working for IBM, might have contributed something I wasn't entitled to contribute. It's not a slam dunk that IBM can recover. They actually have to prove that they have rights to that code and that I could not have independently created that code or acquired the rights to it from some legitimate source.
But Eric, I'm asking you, Eric, and I'm asking your audience and all your friends out there, Eric, to explain to me, now, I know that this is not nefarious, I know it's not deliberate, but it's questionable. Now, why do you guys want me to encourage the federal government or anybody else to invest in a model that could lead to this type of litigation. I mean,
I don't want you to encourage the federal government to do anything. I just want you to stop publishing things that aren't true.
Well, wait a minute. Yeah. I'm going to ask you a very specific question, Eric. Tell me, how can you endorse something where you're telling me you can't certify where it came from, and you can't tell me whether or not I'm going to be sued if I use it? How can you tell me I should use it?
Mr. Brown, let me sure. ask you a question on that matter, because that is important. If a closed source piece of software, now you say that's a better solution for this. Now, if you have a closed source piece of software, who is it, and what process do you encourage people to certify that they're not using any open source software inside that closed source software?
Because there's a more basic question. Ken, why do you think that closed source vendors warrant the intellectual property purity of their software? What reason do you have to...
I'll tell you why.
Any better than us?
I'll tell you why. Because of indemnification. That's the difference. Okay? And you know what, guys? What really alarms me about all this is your friend IBM. And you know what IBM has said about all this? IBM has said they're not indemnifying any of their customers. Any of them.
In fact, if you look at the indemnity of
and you know, I have to wonder, you know, if IBM, with all their money in the bank, wants me, a small college or a small hospital, to invest millions of dollars in their software, and they're telling me that they can't guarantee me anything about its source or origin, and they want my money, and I get sued. I mean, how is IBM innocent in all this? If they want to indemnify their
users. And you know what I have to say to that, Ken? I've looked at these indemnification programs from Microsoft and the other closed source vendors, and they are scams. If you look at the fine print, three of the indemnity is capped by the purchase price of the software. So if you get sued, the most you can recover, the most you're shielded from a lawsuit, is the couple $100 for the price of the software. These so-called indemnifications that these closed-source vendors are giving you are worth nothing if you ever get sued. Nothing.
Well, IBM gives you nothing, Eric, so what do you say to that?
So I'm saying that all of the ire that you're focusing on open-source software for supposedly lacking indemnification and exposing people to third-party lawsuits would be more properly directed at closed-source vendors who are doing exactly the same thing but don't even have the guts to reveal their code so it can be audited.
Well, Eric, all I have to say is that, you know what, I think that it doesn't matter what you're selling. I mean, you know, whether you're selling grapes to a guy that makes wine. I mean, all this stuff gets complicated. And all I'm saying is that, you know, it has to be sorted out. It can't just get a pass. So right now, you know, folks beat up on me a little bit because I ask a few questions, but I don't really see what the big deal is. I mean, people ask
you're
questions about a lot of
you
stuff.
Because you're printing things that aren't true.
Well, Eric, whatever you want to talk about that's not true, I'd be happy to talk about it line for line. But I have still not received as a matter of fact, the biggest reason why I'm on the show right now is because I encourage people to correct me. I want people to tell me, show me where I'm wrong.
Why did you say to me three weeks ago I won't debate this with you?
What's it now?
Why did you say an email to me 3 weeks ago I won't debate this with you? If you're so open to correction. I still have that email. I can produce it.
What are you saying exactly? What are you saying? That
three
I
weeks
what?
Ago you wrote to me an email when I brought up these factual points. If you're so open to correction, why do I have that email?
What does the email say, Eric? What did I say? What did
you
it say?
I brought up these factual points about you having your history wrong and your legal analysis wrong and your economics completely wrong, and you said, I will not debate this with you.
I'll probably be a jovial, Eric. Come on. Listen, Eric, look. If I sit down with Rob Limo and talk about stuff, you know I'll talk to you. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, Eric,
specifically denied any interest in doing that 3 weeks ago.
Eric, that's not... Eric, listen, I apologize. And anybody that wants to talk to me about any of this stuff, if you want to talk to me, I get hundreds of emails. I answer every email I can. You know, I'll talk to anybody. If you have a question you want to talk, if you want to correct me on something, fine. I mean, I'm open to this. All I'm trying to get people to understand is, I mean, it doesn't mean that I'm, you know, in any paid off guy by this guy or that guy. And heck, like Rob pointed out, lots of people, you know, disagree with me on all this stuff. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't mean that the debate goes away. It just changes. And I think that for you guys to win anyway, these questions, hard questions have to get answered. And I mean, I don't think I'm doing anything more than making your case.
Thank you, Ken. We do love you.
I'm just making your case.
Hey, man, next week, you and I need to do a one-on-one next week or the week after, all right?
Hey, anytime.
I think we should. It'll be a fun article. Yeah, we can't enlighten them. At least we can amuse them. Am I right?
That's right.
We're up the time. In fact, we're well over the time. Ken, I really do appreciate you having come out tonight. In fact, I'd like to invite you to come on again in about a month, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
That'll give everybody a chance to, you know, the evidence that people are talking about. It'll give people a chance to swap emails and get their positions, and I'll get the financials from IBM.
We'll
get it together in about one more month. How's that sound?
Hey, that's great. And like I said, guys, you know, I'm pro science, and I think the only way you come up with the best technology is to have these discussions. And anytime you guys want to talk about anything, it doesn't have to be open source. It could be any technology discussion going on in Washington. I'd love to hear what you think about it.
Smoke. Why is anyway. I like that one.
What's that now? Well, I didn't hear what you said. What'd you say?
I'm on my speakerphone. My handset died. I want to go back to the secondhand smoke and why industrial waste is good for you, ADTI papers. I love the heck out of them. Those were Greg's, not yours, that I know.
Well, I tell you what, I have a hard enough time taking responsibility for the stuff I've published.
I highly recommend you do not take credit for other people's stuff, because
at least not without attribution, right?
Yeah, at least give them
that's
attribution.
That's right. You know, I tell you guys, man, I got 100 footnotes in these papers, man, and you know, the first thing I do when I work on any of this stuff is talk to folks that disagree with me. And, you know, I really value the relationships I have with everybody across the spectrum, because, you know, you're not going to learn how to think or improve what you're doing if you only talk to people that agree with you. And that's something I just don't believe in. I mean, you got to talk to people that disagree with you all the time to improve what you're doing. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys.
Okay, well, thank you for coming out. We appreciate it, and I'll be in touch with you about the next show.
Anytime. Take care, fellas. Bye.
No problem. Take care. On behalf of our whole crew here, this has been, shall we say, a pretty interesting show. I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit next week on the show. Our guest on next week's show is Damn Small Linux. So that's going to be an interesting show in its own right. We'll be checking out the Damn Small Linux distro during the course of the next week. So everybody, same time next week. This has been the Linux Show for July the 13th, 2004. Thanks for stopping by. We're out of here.